Well, hello and welcome to the latest in the series of RVC veterinary podcasts, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name's Mark Cleesby, and today I'm going to be talking with Dr. Kate Chandler, who's a neurologist here at the Royal Veterinary College. And today we're going to be talking about the problem of canine epilepsy. So, Kate, perhaps you could start off by just letting us know what exactly epilepsy is and how common it is in dogs.
Mm-hmm. Epilepsy is the tendency to have recurrent fits, and it can be caused by many underlying disease processes. What we normally talk about regarding epilepsy in dogs is something called idiopathic epilepsy, which is a condition that's thought to be inherited or have some genetic basis in most dogs. But when we do investigations on the structure of the brain and the metabolic systems, we don't find any definite underlying cause to it. But essentially, all epilepsy means is the tendency to have fits or seizures. So it's a brain disorder, which is really due, if we look at all the epilepsies, to increased excitement within the brain. So the brain is firing off too rapidly and in an uncontrolled way.
Okay, and is it a common disease in dogs? I mean, how many sort of dogs do you get presented in, say, first opinion practice with seizures of this nature?
Mm-hmm. Epilepsy is the most common chronic neurological disorder in dogs, and it certainly is one of the more common neurological diseases that vets see in practice. And as a referral centre here, we see usually several epileptic animals per week. So it really is a very common disorder. We see it in many different breeds. We see it in crossbred dogs as well as pedigree dogs. And they're usually quite young when they start to have fits. Dogs with idiopathic epilepsy normally start presenting from about 6 months of age up to about 5 years, although occasionally we do see it in young puppies and in older dogs as well.
Okay, so I mean, it sounds like very much a diagnosis of exclusion in the first instance. I mean, what's the sort of process involved then in diagnosing epilepsy and differentiating it from other causes of seizures in dogs?
Uh-huh. What we do is, if an animal comes into our clinic that has a history of recurring epileptic fits, or what we think are epileptic fits, then the first thing to think about is whether those fits are due primarily to a brain problem, or could it be another body system indirectly affecting the brain. And we normally talk about intracranial diseases, so things inside the brain, and extracranial diseases, things outside the brain. Now, the common intracranial diseases, the brain diseases, are, as I've said, idiopathic epilepsy, but then also there are many other possible underlying causes too. They would include brain tumours in elderly dogs, and unfortunately brain tumours are very common in dogs. In younger dogs, things like inflammations and infections of the brain can also actually cause epileptic fits, usually with other symptoms as well, but certainly that's something that we usually need to rule out. Also, some young dogs can be born with abnormal structure of the brain. The most common would be hydrocephalus, or water on the brain, and that's something that we see usually in toy breeds of dog, and we see it usually at a young age, although it can present a bit later on as well. Now, all those structural diseases, if you like, can be ruled in or out by doing a brain scan, and so that would be one part of our investigation. The diseases outside the brain are things such as liver disease, and if the liver is not working correctly, then toxins will build up in the blood, and those can actually indirectly affect the brain function, and epileptic fits could be one outcome of that. Occasionally we see problems with low blood glucose as well, low blood sugar, which can also cause epileptic fits. And those sorts of diseases we will rule out by doing a series of other tests, usually blood tests, but also things like abdominal ultrasound, for example, if we wanted to examine the liver more closely. So there are usually, in an animal who presents with epileptic fits, there are a number of different tests that we need to do to essentially rule out the causes of those fits. And if all those tests are negative, then we're really left with a diagnosis of idiopathic epilepsy, which, as I said, is usually thought to be inherited to a certain extent and certainly to have genetic aspects to it.
Right. So, I mean, within that category of idiopathic epilepsy, I mean, I guess the human equivalent will involve a number of different types of epilepsy, different syndromes. Is there a comparable categorization in animals, or is, as you've mentioned, a genetic predisposition, is there particular breeds which might help you to differentiate different types of epilepsy, for example?
Right. That's a very interesting question. Certainly in human neurology, there are many different epileptic syndromes that are recognised, and those are characterised using different characteristics, really, including specific genes in people that can be involved in specific epilepsies, and also these diseases will have specific epileptic fit types, so the type of seizure might help to categorise that sort of disease in people. Now, in dogs, the situation is slightly different because we haven't been able to, as yet, identify any definite genetic links as far as specific genes in epilepsies in dogs. However, we do think that certain breeds of dog do have different sorts of epilepsy from the point of view. Some breeds seem to present earlier in age than others, and some breeds seem to have different sorts of seizure types compared to others. Right. So there are vague differences between the breeds of epilepsy, but as yet, veterinary neurologists have not been able to very accurately categorise those, and that is work that's going on at the moment using some of the advanced tests that we have now for dogs.
Yes, so I was going to come to that next. There are obviously a number of now newer diagnostic modalities available which are obviously of great use in neurology, such as MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, or EEG, electroencephalograms, which may help out in this way. Is this something that you're making more use of, and perhaps helping then to differentiate different types of epilepsy in dogs?
Very much so. So MRI is an extremely detailed tool that we have for looking at brain structure, which is available here to look at the brain of dogs. And in almost all cases of animals that have recurrent epileptic fits, MRI is one diagnostic test that can potentially be very useful. Now, the beauty of MRI is you can see the structure of the brain in a lot of detail, and this enables us to diagnose such conditions as the congenital structural disorders, such as water on the brain, hydrocephalus, but also the inflammatory infectious diseases will also often show up changes on MRI scans. And then finally, brain tumours can be identified usually quite easily using MRI. And so there are a lot of things that we can rule in and rule out using MRI as a tool. And unfortunately, at this stage in time, there aren't any specific changes on MRI that are usually associated with idiopathic epilepsy. So in that condition, MRI is usually normal. Now, what MRI doesn't tell you necessarily is actually whether the brain is definitely having an epileptic fit. And occasionally we do see cases of dogs that are having strange episodes, which are not necessarily typical of the common types of epileptic fit. Now, doing an MRI in those dogs doesn't actually tell you whether the dog is having a fit or not.
Yes. So we're talking here of things like fly catching and those sorts of behaviours.
Exactly. Yeah. Some of the partial fits that only involve a small part of the brain being active during the fit don't always look typical of epilepsy. And so we're looking for, in those cases, perhaps a more functional tool which actually looks at brain function rather mm-hmm. than brain structure. So MRI, in most cases, is just looking at brain structure. So this is where EEG comes in, and we're very lucky to be able to EEG our patients with a digital EEG system. And the EEG involves putting small electrodes under the skin on the dog's head, and the idea of this is that it actually picks up the brainwave activity across the surface of the cerebral cortex, which is the part of the brain that is responsible for epileptic activity. And what we can do with that is it can help identify foci or specific areas of the brain that are actually firing off during the epileptic fit. And some epileptic dogs do actually have abnormal EEG activity even between their epileptic fits. Mm-hmm. This is a relatively new tool for us here at the RVC, and we're finding that as we use it more, that it is becoming useful to try and differentiate between episodes that are either epileptic or not epileptic, and that does give us an idea of brain function.
Okay, so is this a modality which is well established perhaps in other referral institutions, or is it quite new everywhere?
So EEG as a tool is not actually a new diagnostic tool. It's something that's been used for many decades, both in human neurology and in veterinary neurology as well. However, there are and have been historically some technical problems using EEG in animals compared to people. And that's because, first of all, our patients aren't quite as amenable to getting recordings, especially if little needles have to be put under the skin. Although it's not very painful, some dogs find it a little bit irritating, and so it's difficult sometimes for them to sit still. Also, dogs have more muscle on their heads. The temporal muscle, which sits on the surface of the skull, is much more prominent in animals than it is in humans, and so that can make it more difficult to get a diagnostic recording. Mm-hmm. However, with the EEG systems that we have available, with repeated recordings and with growing experience, it is possible to get diagnostic recordings in animals, and it's not something that many referral centres are using at the moment, because MRI really has been the primary tool for a long time for actually localising problems in the brain. But certainly with if we want to further understand epilepsy, then EEG is becoming a more and more useful tool to actually help categorise some of these epilepsies, similar to how they are in people.
Okay, so now turning towards treatment and prognosis, I guess, I mean, how frequent should epileptiform seizures be before you advise intervention, or what is your target, I guess, for treatment? And if one sort of leaves these alone, I mean, how serious a problem is it? What is the long-term prognosis with this sort of disease?
It's a very good question, and quite a difficult question too, because we don't fully know how we can predict the prognosis of epilepsy. Now, we have a few guidelines of when seizures should be treated. Certainly, if an animal is having a seizure once a month or more frequently than once a month, then we would almost always recommend treatment for that animal. So if an animal is having a seizure, say, only every 3 months or every 6 months, then we probably wouldn't recommend treatment. Mm-hmm. However, it very much depends on the animal. Some animals have more severe seizures than others. There are some particular types of seizure activity which can be more serious and potentially more life-threatening. And the two examples of that are either clusters of fits or seizures, which essentially mean more than one fit a day.
Yeah.
And also if there has been a period of status epilepticus, which is a longer period of uncontrolled seizure activity, which the animal doesn't come out of spontaneously. And both of those are potentially life-threatening events, and those need to be treated aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
Also, just going back to seizure type, in some animals with epileptic fits that only involve part of the brain, partial fits, then sometimes we don't necessarily recommend that those are treated perhaps as aggressively as the generalised ones, because they seem to be less likely to go on then to develop the more serious event of status epilepticus.
So I guess my time back in practice, I recall reaching for the phenobarbitone in these situations. Now, is that still the mainstay of treatment for idiopathic canine epilepsy, or have times changed?
We still use phenobarbitone as one of our first-line medications. Phenobarbitone is a very effective anti-epileptic drug in dogs and cats, and in most animals that will be one of our first-line medications anyway. We also use a drug called potassium bromide as a first-line anti-epileptic drug in some dogs. The advantage of potassium bromide is that it doesn't have any effect on hepatic function, on liver function, whereas phenobarbitone at high doses or high levels in the blood can actually lead to toxicity over long term anyway. There are, however, some much newer drugs available as well now. Now, these are come from human medicine, and at times we have thought that these could be the sort of easy solution for canine epilepsy. However, they're not a quick fix, and usually we're only using them as a sort of a second or a third line medication in animals that have already had phenobarbitone and or bromide.
Mm-hmm. So is bromide used as an alternative to phenobarbitone or in addition, or is it a case-by-case basis?
We can use it as either. So in some cases we'll use phenobarbitone. If that's not effective once we reach high levels in the blood, that we will then add bromide as an additional drug, and they are safe to use together. In some animals who won't tolerate phenobarbitone, say for example if the side effects are unacceptable in that particular patient, we may swap to potassium bromide. Mm-hmm. Also, if we are worried about liver function, then we might start using potassium bromide as a first line medication straight away. The disadvantage of bromide over phenobarbitone is that it takes a lot longer to build up in the blood to therapeutic doses, so it can actually take around 3 months or longer to actually reach a steady level in the blood, whereas phenobarbitone only takes 2 weeks to build up to what we would call therapeutic levels in the blood.
Okay, so I guess the circulating concentration in the blood is fairly crucial. I mean, I guess one of the frustrations in practice is that a lot of patients being treated for epilepsy respond in different ways, and often clients can be concerned that the drug protocol isn't really controlling the seizures. Now, what are the sort of factors that you take into account then when a dog's seizures aren't under control using, for example, pentobarbitone?
First of all, we look at what the seizure frequency is, how often the animal is having epileptic fits. And if we are unhappy with the response, then what we will do is measure the therapeutic levels in the blood. And what we normally try and aim for is those levels to be at the high end of what we would consider the therapeutic level. And if we are then, if the oral dose hasn't achieved the concentration in the blood that we would like, we might then increase the dose of phenobarbitone until we actually get to an appropriate therapeutic level. If we have then reached the maximum dose of phenobarbitone that we're happy with by measuring the levels in the blood, we would then add a second medication. But I think it's important that we need to look at what the likely outcome is going to be. It is usually unreasonable to expect an animal to have no seizures at all as an epileptic animal. Although having a fit can be quite distressing for an owner to see, in most cases, animals we think are fully unaware of having a fit. Certainly that's true in people that have generalised fits. And so sometimes it's better for an animal to tolerate one fit every couple of months rather than to give it so much medication that the side effects become more of a problem than the fits themselves. So that's always really a toss-up, really, on, you know, what side effects can we tolerate in a patient, and how bad are the fits, and how life-threatening potentially are the fits.
So are there sort of, I guess, particular newer drugs which do hold promise then for alternatives as epilepsy treatment in dogs, for example, with fewer liver side effects? I mean, do you have any specifics in mind that you've tried, or any promising ones on the horizon?
Right, so there are a few other options now. One of the most useful ones we're finding currently is a drug called levetiracetam. This is a human anti-epileptic drug, and one of my colleagues here, Dr. Holger Volk, did a study using this medication in dogs, and we found that actually it was effective in some dogs that were resistant to phenobarbitone and potassium bromide, so they were continuing to have fits despite that treatment. If those dogs then had levetiracetam as an add-on medication, so that would be a third line medication effectively, then the seizure frequency decreased in many of those dogs. Now this, we thought, might be a fantastic solution because levetiracetam does not have problems with liver toxicity and has very few side effects. However, the effect of levetiracetam does not seem to be long-term. So in dogs that are treated with levetiracetam, they may have improved seizure frequency for, say, around 6 months, but then the seizures start to come back. So that's a concern, and that's something that we are trying really to think of different ways of using this drug to avoid this problem. There are other drugs available as well. Another example of a human drug that we do use for epilepsy is called gabapentin. Gabapentin, again, is a drug that has a few side effects. It can cause sedation sometimes, but doesn't have a high risk of any toxicity to the liver. And again, we can use that as an add-on drug. And in some dogs who have clusters of fits, that can actually improve the seizure frequency as well. But at the moment, we find levetiracetam to be a very effective addition in these dogs.
Okay, well, that sounds very interesting for the future. I guess maybe I should just finish by asking, well, I suppose, firstly saying that most cases of seizures are presumably dealt with in general practice, but under what circumstances would you be encouraging owners or vets then to refer on their patients? Is this in cases of particularly uncontrolled seizures or with particular presentations, or what's your opinion on that?
I mean, I think that certainly any difficulties in controlling the fits, that's certainly a scenario that it would be sensible, I think, to perhaps consider doing other investigations and perhaps referral to a veterinary neurologist. And then what we're able to do is to investigate in detail what the underlying causes could be, but then also to talk about some perhaps more advanced treatment options for the patient. Also, if the veterinary surgeon is suspicious that there could be another underlying cause which may need MRI to diagnose, and that might include perhaps an older patient who's presenting with seizures after 5 years of age, which might have a higher likelihood of something underlying, such as a brain tumour. Also in animals that are very young, who are presenting less than 6 months of age, because these animals may have something like a congenital structural disorder, such as water on the brain, hydrocephalus, or an inflammatory or infectious underlying cause of their fits. Finally, an animal with idiopathic epilepsy usually is normal in between the fits. So if an animal is having fits in combination with other neurological signs, such as behaviour changes or problems with walking, coordination, that kind of thing, then that might also suggest that there's a more serious underlying brain condition other than just idiopathic epilepsy. So all of those situations would be potential considerations for referral to a neurologist for further investigations.
Okay, excellent. And I understand there's a brand spanking new MRI arriving at the Hawkshead campus fairly soon.
Yes, and we're very excited that in the future we're going to have an on-site MRI scanner which we will be able to use throughout the week, and we're hoping that this is going to be able to provide a more efficient, rapid service for our patients. It means that we can MRI potentially on any day of the week, and it's also going to help us understand diseases that we are interested in, such as epilepsy, and we're going to be able to hopefully answer some of the questions that we still have about epilepsy in dogs with our new machine.
Great. Well, Kate Chandler, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you found that podcast both entertaining and informative. If you have any comments regarding the podcasts as broadcast, you can write to podcast@rvc.ac.uk with any comments or suggestions. Thank you very much for listening.